Welcome to House State Affairs. It is 3:03 p.m. Thursday, February 27th. Martha, do you mind calling the roll?
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw? Representative Hopkins? Representative Story? Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Here.
And let the record reflect that Representative Hopkins is here and Representative Shaw is excused. We have a quorum to do business. Representative Story is here as well. Representative Clayman is in the room to present House Bill 148. Thanks, Martha Moore and Madison Truitt. So with that, let's go to House Bill 148, Marriage Witnesses, with Representative Clayman and his staff. This is the second hearing in House State Affairs. Does the sponsor have additional remarks? No additional remarks. No amendments were received on this bill. So with that, I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 148. Is there anyone wishing to testify on this bill who is in the room? Not seeing anyone. I don't see anyone online to testify to House Bill 148, so I'll close public testimony. Do committee members have questions for the sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, does the sponsor have closing remarks? Seeing none, do I have a motion to move this legislation?
Mr. Chair, I move the committee report on HB 148-31-LS0049-M with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there an objection? Okay, Representative Vance, do you wish to speak to your objection?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the maker of this bill for the willingness to address my questions and concerns and provide the copy of the marriage license application. And it shows me other areas that need to be addressed when it comes to being able to get married in Alaska. And I understand the bill is addressing two witnesses, but the instructions on the marriage certificate and just the lack of ease of obtaining a marriage license was not as easy as what we thought. And that is something that could be addressed. But I see the value in wanting to make the marriage industry easier for people who are coming. But I'm not able to support this. I feel that the voters in my district and who elected me and for myself, easing the two witness requirement, I just can't get past that. And I tried to look into the marriage license application and the requirements for that. And it was just a hurdle that I couldn't get past. And I'm not sure if it's based upon values, but I thank you for Representative Clayman for walking me through a lot of that, and it is in no offense against your bill or against the industry, and just wanted to state that for the record that it was looked at and that I hope that the license application can be reworked to make that clearer for applicants on the process of applying and getting married, and that may be one of the hurdles that we could do to help the industry as well, in besides the two witness requirement. Thank you.
Okay, so it sounds like the objection is maintained. Are there other comments on this bill? Okay, Madam Secretary, could you call the roll?
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
No.
Representative Shaw? Not present. Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
Okay.
One nay.
Thank you. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the bill, and after that, we will go to rehabilitation and reentry. We have a couple of finishing invited testimony. We're going to have a couple of folks testify, Ron Wilson and a colleague of his, and then we will return to the presentation with Laura Brooks. So brief at ease. On the record, House State Affairs, a couple weeks ago we had a presentation by Department of Corrections, as well as testimony. And we are going to return to that subject, starting with invited testimony. So, and after two people for invited testimony, we'll go back to the presentation from DOC. I really appreciate DOC coming back. And with that, Mr. Wilson, do you want to put yourself on the record and talk about your experience with the therapeutic courts?
Yes, I will. My name is Ron Wilson. I'm a board member of the Alaska Therapeutic Court Alumni Organization. I am 54 years old, and I'm a 53-year resident of Anchorage, Alaska, married father of four, IBEW electrician, 28-year member of the IBEW. I'm also a 2010 felony drug court graduate from the Alaska Therapeutic Court system. And I'd like to just tell you that a little bit about myself and share that testimony. I'm a high school graduate, and I actually started my alcohol use at the age of 15. I come from a traditional family, my mother and father and four brothers, and actually I'm one of five that has ever had any interaction with the judicial system and the court system, as well as being an addict. So, and I started drinking at the age of 15, and I tried marijuana at the age of 16, and played football for 9 years, but gradually as things progressed, I started to lose the interest in those type of activities. And so after graduation, I started to what had started as just being a recreational type of engagement with alcohol and drugs soon morphed into an addiction. So I started, never had any incarceration until 1996, where I got my first DUI. I met my wife in 91. Her and I were coming from a Christmas party, and I picked up my first DUI in 96. And from there, learned that it's been a three-year cycle. So in 99, I got my second DUI. 2002, I got a felony DUI. In 91, I became an IBEW member. And so in 2002, receiving a felony sentence, it just changed my life drastically. And so it got my attention. From there, I started getting some intensive outpatient treatment, learned that I was medicating an anxiety disorder. So unbeknownst to me, something that started out as just recreational, it turned into a means of self-medicating. So after that felony DUI, I knew that I had to change my life around. But I substituted one substance for another. 2005, I picked up a misconduct involving a controlled substance after being pulled over. The substance was cocaine. And it's cocaine. Something that was pretty much socially acceptable back in the 80s, but regardless, it was a problem. And so in 2008, I picked up a second misconduct involving a controlled substance. And then at which point I was accepted, I was looking at a six-year sentence. And being married and having four kids, that was a critical time. So I did 6 months of inpatient treatment at the Aquila, state-funded treatment program. Did 6 months there, and then I was transferred into the therapeutic court. Therapeutic court gave me the opportunity to address my treatment issues. Also, as a nonviolent offender, it allowed me to do my address this legal issue at home, opposed to being incarcerated. So I went back to work and did an 18-month-long program at the therapeutic courts. And learned how to manage my anxiety disorder, and haven't looked back since. So I've been clean now for 10 years. I am a homeowner, a property owner, a business owner, and currently working out of the IBEW. So things have just amazingly have turned around. The one point I'd like to make is that there's only a certain amount of slots for therapeutic court participants. I believe in Anchorage is 60, and it's less in Palmer and then Kenai and also in Fairbanks, so and also here as well. So the necessity for other offenders to have the access and opportunity to receive those types of services that can drastically change their lives around, it's imperative that that the state continues to try and find ways of funding reentry programs and those other organizations and resources that will help people get their lives changed around. There's a lot of people out there that are looking for help. And a lot of people out there, once they receive that help, can be extremely successful, just as we have. So I just encourage you to take a look at bridging that gap of people trying to look for help, because drugs and alcohol takes good people to bad places. And so thanks to you all and your funding. We ask just for continued funding for these type of opportunities for people that are out there offended and have allowed their lives to change around. That's pretty much pretty much it. Thank you. Thank you for
Thanks,
your time.
Mr. Wilson. Do committee members have questions? Representative Price Hopkins.
Incredibly compelling testimony. Thank you. I've heard from judges, I've heard from public defenders, I've heard from prosecutors, and now I've heard from graduates of the program how great therapeutic courts are for many people, maybe not for everybody, but for many people compared to the sort of inflexibility of the standard criminal justice system. I'm curious from your perspective, beyond money and recognizing money is a major variable, if there are other things we as the legislature can do to further empower the therapeutic court system or sort of make it more mainstream and get more people into it who would benefit from it.
Well, just the expansion of the program is would be incredible, and also the other wraparound services. One of the hurdles is that a lot of people in their addiction and alcohol use have lost the ability to have sustainable housing. And so that's a component. So rather than having people incarcerated once they get out, if we get them some housing, then they can start to address their substance and alcohol issues. So those type of wraparound services are important to help people get the treatment, things that they need. So and again, it's and also the peer-to-peer component, because we as an alumni organization continue to have developed a rapport and alliance and network with reentry programs to offer peer support to give some help other people, offenders, navigate through the recovery process, if you will.
Follow up. Thank you. And what's your understanding of demand, if you will, for spots in the program relative to availability in the therapeutic court system?
The demand is how they basically judge that is there's treatment slots, and so there's a large demand for people that are trying to get. I don't have exact numbers, but there's a large demand, and there's a lot of people that are being turned away because there's only say 60 treatment slots that are available for those potential offenders to come in and participate in the therapeutic courts. I don't know the exact numbers, but I also know that it operates at about close to a sixth of the cost of incarceration. So there is a financial component that's beneficial if you use that alternate justice opposed to the conventional justice system.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And thank you for coming and talking. I met with a couple therapeutic courts graduates last year as well, and heard amazing testimony. Similar at Fairbanks, where I'm from. You said you're the president of the board. Is that in Anchorage?
Yes.
Who else? What is the makeup of that board? Is it predominantly graduates? Are there attorneys or other people who come in?
Yeah, it's complete. It's exclusively for graduates.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
It's absolutely alumni, completely alumni run.
Yeah,
wow.
It's a great question because we started the alumni group in 2006, and we speak nationally for the other therapeutic courts across the nation, and we have been the longest running alumni group in the country. So, but it's taken some time.
Absolutely.
We're building up traction, and people like Tommy have engaged and saw some attraction, and it also helps sustain the game. So for me personally, I just saw that there was going to be a need of some sort of program, if you will, after the stringent structure of the therapeutic courts. Because once the courts go away, the UAs and the demands from the court proceedings, then you're on your own. Everything has to be self-imposed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always the easiest.
No, it's not.
So that peer-to-peer component, which is offered through the alumni group, is big.
Thank you, and thanks for giving back and everybody being involved with it. Does the board have any responsibilities for implementing the therapeutic courts program? Is there an administrative job that you guys undertake as a board, or is it all run through corrections or courts or something else?
No, it's actually we have a rapport with the courts, the treatment team, and so as the chair and group coordinator, I meet with the program coordinators statewide, and then we work hand in hand on whatever issues and the components that would help benefit their current participants to go through. So we do process groups where the current participants can sit weekly. They're required to be there, and then us as graduates can help them understand the challenges and the successes of what we experienced as we went through the program.
So that board is alumni, volunteer, and then most of what you provide is, I guess I'm just repeating this back, you make sure I understand, most of what you provide then as the board is following up with the graduates, making sure they stay on it, making sure they know where to find the services. Hey, here's a housing program, here's an employment program, sort of things like that, to continue helping them to make the program more successful. Your volunteer work is helping ensure that it remains successful.
That's exactly correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as well as, you know, networking with the reentry.
Absolutely, program. Absolutely.
Representative Story.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for sharing today. It's admirable. I appreciate you giving back and helping other people to say this is good and this is we can get to a place where we want to be. So thank you. I am wondering what support your family got or does get through the program.
Well, that's a good question. Currently, right now, as the alumni group, Tommy has developed what's called the monthly game night. And that's this is newly implemented over about the last 6 months, where there's a sober activity that the alumni provides an activity for the current participants to go and spend an evening to do game night. And so, and because typically it's most of the groups and the process groups and the treatment is all exclusively just for the current participants, but we've they have started up in a monthly game night where the current participants could bring in their family, friends, children, and so. And it's usually upwards of about 50 to 70 people that attend those functions. And so it's a means of allowing family to come together, and also for the kids to see their parents doing different types of activities than what they were witnessing prior to.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Of course.
So when you were going through the program, there were not other supports for your family members? It was mostly the supports that you got?
Mostly. There was one portion of the outpatient treatment, there was a family counseling or a family portion of that where you'd pick a family member and they would attend the two-hour mm-hmm. slot for treatment. So that was pretty much it. But then my mother, she was always there at all my court proceedings, which we had once a week. And so she was very supportive in that aspect, too, as well as people, spouses, and significant others would also participate in the court proceedings.
Thank you.
And maybe in addition to, like, our summer picnics and the holiday parties and things like that where everybody can bring in their family members. That's a pretty big component.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Wilson. Feel free to stay there while Mr. Roll gives his testimony. If you can put yourself on record and – oh, sorry. Representative Christ Tompkins had another question.
Just one more question, Mr. Wilson. This might seem a bit afield to the subject of today's hearing, but you were describing when you're struggling with your relationship with alcohol in the 90s, you had got a number of DUIs. Do you have an SR-22 car insurance requirement, high-risk vehicle insurance that you have to pay as a consequence of that?
I did back then, but my felony DUI was back in 2002, so I've gotten past all of those requirements. But I did. I had to carry it back then. It was a five-year requirement.
Okay.
And it was, I believe it was a five-year revocation, opposed mm-hmm. to now it's a lifetime revocation with a possibility of getting a limited license after 10 years.
Okay. Thank you. The reason I ask is we're hearing a bill on that subject, not related to DUIs, but something else on Tuesday, and I was curious about your experience.
Okay. It was expensive.
Just follow up?
Sure.
how much was it a month?
It was an additional $100 a month for me for the 5 years. So okay. When you do the math, that was like $6,000.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? And how did that affect you on a personal level, that extra $500 a month?
It was a financial hardship, drastically, yeah. As well as all the other penalties. It was a $10,000 fine, and but I, you know, that was all my fault. So, but yeah, the financial component of that is an extreme hardship mm-hmm. to my family. Yes.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
You're welcome.
Representative Story.
Yeah, this is kind of follow-up to my questions before, because I was just thinking, as you were going through that experience, had your family talked about the need for more family supports, and has the board currently, obviously you've developed the game night, but is that something that the board has been exploring other avenues to do that?
Yes, we have. And there's been some requests of significant others being able to participate in some of the process groups, where the weekly process groups, where participants can come and talk about the situations and issues that they go through. But the dilemma is that the court team is not able to vet all of the significant others and the other people that are coming through. So there's that part of making sure that the participants are not being exposed to a situation or a person that might be harmful. And so we're currently and always looking at adding additional groups, maybe a family group. Thing is that as facilitators for those groups, it's a voluntary position because there's no funds for it. So it's hard to find people that will take that time to go and have a group just for family members or just for couples and things like that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, Mr. Roll, do you want to put yourself on record and give your testimony?
My name's Thomas Roll. I'm a board member of the Alaska Therapeutic Court alumni. I'm activities director.
And if you could go ahead and slide that mic over there. There you go. Just talk right into the mic so that people can hear. Thank you.
You want to start over?
Sure.
My name's Thomas Roll, and I'm a director on the board of the Alaska Therapeutic Court alumni. I'm the activities director, and like he said, I started the game night, but we also organize other events for families, and that's like bowling, and this summer we're going to try and do disc golf for families and friends. You know, we're going to try and organize as much as we can to get family involved, because we find that very important and therapeutic.
Yeah. And if you don't mind sharing your story and your experiences with therapeutic courts.
I'm not as polished as him, by the way. He's pretty good. So my journey started about 8 years ago, I guess. I hurt my back, and I had to get I hurt my back. It between my L5 and my L4, it burst, and I didn't have really any funding or anything. So they sent me to a pain clinic, and I got Medicaid, and they gave me 90 Dilaudids a month, and they couldn't really find any kind of treatment for me to fix it because I was on Medicaid, anyone that would handle a Medicaid surgery. After about a year of taking 90 Dilaudids a month and abusing them, they found someone that would do the surgery with Medicaid. And after the surgery, I was fixed. And they took away the pain medication. And I went back to them and I said, hey, look, I'm addicted, you know, and they said, hey, no problem, and they gave me 90 Suboxones a month, and I didn't know how Suboxone worked, but it didn't work for me. I found out later, way later in addiction, how it worked, but so I found out I could sell them for $20 a piece, and I went out and sold all of my Suboxone the first day I would get them, and then I would go out and try to find pills, the same kind of pills I was kind of getting. I was looking for something called Roxaset, which is around the time when they quit making OxyContin. It's basically the same thing, just in a lower amount, 30 milligrams. Well, once you can't find pills, I happened to be with a friend of mine that said, why are you paying so much for these pills, you know? And he introduced me to heroin, and once you find heroin, there's almost no escaping. I literally worshipped heroin. And once you find heroin, you find meth, you find coke, you find crack. I mean, you pretty much do whatever you can find whenever you're not feeling good or withdrawing. And through my addiction, one of the darkest moments that I've had was when the firefighters Narcan'd me. And when I came to, I was mad at them because they saved my life. I was actually trying to OD and let myself go.
You can take your time.
Yeah.
Take your time.
Yeah.
So a couple months after that experience, it's kind of hard to try to do it a second time, because if you're not successful, it's like, I don't want to do that again, you know. But So a couple months later, I ran into another individual that I've never seen again since, but it was like a 15-minute window. I met this guy named Frank Tomoganok. He was a graduate of the Alaska Therapeutic Court, and he told me a little bit about it, and he told me that you got to have a drug-related crime or you got to get a DUI or something. And so a couple more months after that, I'm not quite sure of the timeline. It's all a blur back then, but I'm on my way into Home Depot, and I'm going to go steal some items to pay for my addiction. And on my way in there, I got to thinking about what he told me, and I've been stealing a long time from stores, and I knew who all the loss prevention people are in all these places. And on my way into Home Depot, I decide I'm going to get caught today, and I'm going to try to get into the wellness court. So on my way out the door, I made sure that loss prevention could see me. They tackled me, brought me back into the room, and when the cop finally showed up, he goes, "You got anything to say for yourself?" And I said, "Yeah, I need you to put in your report that I was stealing these items to pay for my addiction." And he goes, "You're telling on yourself?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm trying to get into something called Wellness Court, or the Alaska Therapeutic Court, sorry." And he was very happy to do that for me. He understood exactly what I was trying to do, and it was amazing. And 4 months later, I got into Wellness Court. And one of the things that made Wellness Court so successful for me is in the first 3 months of being in Wellness Court, they put you up for housing for 3 months. They pay for your housing. And you have a rigorous schedule when you first get into Wellness Court, at least when you're assessed very high, which I was. You go to 2 classes a day. You go to 5 NA or AA meetings a week. You go to 1 or 2 alumni meetings a week. You have a very rigorous schedule. And if it wasn't for that housing, because I was homeless at that point when I got into therapeutic court. And another component of how successful it was something called Vivitrol. And what Vivitrol is it blocks the receptors in your brain, and it goes every 28 days, and my first day in wellness court, my first day out of jail, they just let you walk or take a cab to the PO office. And even though I wanted treatment, even when the moment I got out of jail, the first thing I wanted to do was go find some heroin. But I gave it a try anyway. I went to the PO office, and I met with my PO, Ebony Evans, amazing PO, by the way. I said, "Hey, I heard about this thing you guys make us do called Vivitrol. And when can I get this?" And she says, "Well, you're scheduled to go tomorrow." And I said, "I think today's the day." Yeah. So she went out of her way and made an appointment for me. And I went, and so at this point I didn't have Medicaid, but they offered a first time sample. And this medication is not cheap. It's like $900. So, yeah. So they gave it to me, and I kid you not, the moment they put that in me, it erased all need or want for heroin. And everyone's program's different in wellness court, but for me, they made me stay on Vivitrol for 10 months through Medicaid. And I owe pretty much everything to wellness or therapeutic court and Vivitrol and the whole team and people like Ron, who was my peer support through alumni group. It was, man, I can't stress enough how much therapeutic court saves lives. Mm. Now, I'm just going to share about 2 more people real quick. I have a friend of mine. He was a retired railroad. He was a conductor, engineer, and he had problems with alcohol, and I met him through the Alaska Therapeutic Court. He was just married on the 22nd. I happened to be there, you know, and it was amazing to be invited to his wedding. He's like, well, he is my best friend right now. And if we'd have met on the streets any other time, we would have been, I don't know you. I don't like you, you know. And he's a really good guy. And another friend of mine, Drew, he was a respected member of the automotive community until he found meth, and he was shunned instantly when people found out. And through the Alaska Therapeutic Court, he's now back in the automotive industry. And I'm just, man, I can't stress enough how many people I've seen Alaska Therapeutic Court saved lives.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Likewise, thank you. It's incredible testimony. I guess I would just ask the same question I asked before. I mean, from your experience in the court system, or are there ways sort of beyond funding and creating more spaces in the program that we, the legislature, can help?
That's pretty much it, you know. I mean, but so we partnered with Partners for Progress, which is a reentry program, and until there's more slots open, there's a need for programs like this, and that's also a means for people to hear about wellness or therapeutic court, because not everyone knows. I didn't know about it. I've been in and out of jail. I can't even tell you, man. I wish I was. Someone would have told me about this the first time I got caught shoplifting. Like, there's a better way, you know. I feel like when you first go to jail, if you're in there for anything that's kind of drug related, shoplifting, stealing cars, anything, you should automatically be assessed to be a therapeutic court participant. You know, that was one thing I wish would have happened for me 5 years ago. Yeah. And I would have definitely been open to it.
Yes.
Thank you. Can you speak more to your perception of nonviolent offenders who are entering the criminal justice system? How obscure the therapeutic court system is, like how unaware people typically are, sort of in the way that you were just describing.
Well. Pretty much the only way you hear about Alaska Therapeutic Court, and I can vouch for this 100%, is sometimes in therapeutic court they do give you jail sentences. That's usually a last resort, and it's usually 24 hours to 48 hour sentence. And when you're in there for that 24 to 48 hours, you're going to talk about wellness court, and that's pretty much the way the word is spread. And it's a positive experience usually, because it's you know you're getting out. It's not like when you first get out of jail and you don't make your UA or you don't whatever and you get put into jail, you don't know when you're getting out. You know you're getting out, and you know it's just a moment for you to reflect on what you did and what you can do to correct it. And you usually have an assignment while you're in there to come out with something written down about why it won't happen again.
Follow up. So given the way therapeutic court works, because it is so segregated, almost physically, in terms of interpersonal contact from traditional inmates serving time in correctional facilities, there's kind of a firewall of awareness. It's just kind of hearsay and like so-and-so. Could you speak to that a little bit more?
So I don't think it's really segregated. Once you get a sanction that's jailable, you go in for the 24 to 48 hours. They just put you into ECHOMOD. It's not, you're not really segregated. You have a chance to, I mean, but not really, because you're only in with one other roommate. And usually that person has got some kind of a drug-related issue, because I would say, I don't know the percentages, but I would say it's very high of everyone in jail has something to do with drugs.
Representative Thompson has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rule and Mr. Wilson, especially thank you for the courage to come and tell us your stories, because that's hard to do. I was just curious, I mean, your successes, you guys are amazing. Is there much failure in this program as the people go through it? Do you lose some?
Absolutely, yes.
Very, very big percentage, or is it?
I don't know the numbers, but, you know, some people are ready for it and some people aren't. But the ones that are ready for it make it, you know, and they make it very well.
Well, you two are great success stories, and thank you very much.
And there's many, many more. I mean, I can testify to lots of them. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Could you speak a little bit to the kind of qualities that you've seen in your own experience of which people are ready for it, like what the traits are, where they are in life? Are there any sort of common denominators that you've sort of seen?
No, I'm sorry. Addiction is ravaging every walk of life, no matter what economic you come from. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have that.
Just to clarify my question, I mean, not so much who gets addicted, but Representative Thompson asked, you know, what's the success rate? And you were saying, you know, some people, when they get into therapeutic court, they're, you know, ready to dig in and just go for it and do whatever it takes. And then that's not everybody. And some people don't succeed in that way. And I was just wondering to clarify the question, if there were, you'd seen a certain quality or a glint in the eye, or if there's something that you could home in on that differentiates those two categories of people.
Sometimes people use therapeutic court to get out of jail. And at some point, and that's okay. But at some point usually within the first 3 months, I call it the light switch moment. You get it and you see it starts working. And you can see people engaging more, sharing more, at like the alumni, attending their AA or NA, engaging with their sponsor. There's plenty of examples, you know, and the whole team looks for it, and everyone can see when someone's getting it for sure. Yeah. And once you start getting it and you start working your own program, the POs will fight for you. And that's why I'm here, because I believe in it. I believe the POs do fight for you. It's not like when you get out of jail and you have your PO that just wants to put you in jail, you know. And I'm sure you guys have heard about the simulations that are going around, mm-hmm. right? I would like to see a simulation where the therapeutic court has their simulation, because then you can see that you're not going to jail every second. You get maybe a sanction that you go do 4 hours of community work service, or you get 14 hours of community work service. There's alternatives to going to jail.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, you were talking about there's 60 slots in Anchorage for that for the therapeutic courts. Are those always full? And is it the same story in the different communities around the state with therapeutic courts? Are those slots always full?
No, they're not always full, and that just that varies. And I'm not sure how they select what is entailed in the selection process or what makes you meet the criteria, but it's because of the limited amount of spots. There is a vetting process.
And follow up? Sorry, go for it.
Well, no, go ahead, because I'd like to respond to the other question.
Okay. Is it an awareness of the therapeutic courts? Because Mr. Rule was talking about how it's just a lot of word of mouth. When you go back for the short period of time that you go back into jail for a little while, you're able to talk to more people. Is it a lack of awareness, do you think, that is leaving some of those slots open? So if more people knew, more people could go through the vetting process. And at some point, are we able to tell individuals who have been convicted of drug-related crime that this is an option when at conviction that they can go through? Or at some point after they've been in jail for a certain amount of time, is that something you feel would help fill those slots? Because I'm assuming that all the slots are funded.
Yes, they are funded. I think more awareness, increased awareness that program is available is key. And like Tommy was just saying, that a lot of times people don't hear about it until they hear from another offender once they've been placed in incarceration.
I think Mr. Roll wanted to comment on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Roll, if you don't mind just putting yourself back on the record and then.
Yeah, my name is Thomas Roll. So I have had many ideas while I've been in this program, and one of my ideas might come to fruition. I have made many friendships with Ron, Steve, Carlos, they're all board members, and Doreen, Bonnie, there's plenty of them. And one of my ideas was we need to get a video in the jails that represents Alaska Therapeutic Court. And through Partners for Progress, their board, that might come to fruition. I'm not 100% sure on what's going on, but that was one of my ideas that I would like to see happen.
Thank you. One more quick follow-up. As the Department of Corrections comes back up and talks about their reentry programs, I'd love to hear if you guys have any options to help with that video or help with making awareness of this program so we can save 5/6 of the cost and build more success stories.
Thank you. I want to go to Representative Vance, but I think, Mr. Wilson, you wanted to respond to another point.
I would like to respond to the success rate that you were talking about. The most successful people are the ones that complete the drug courts have proven to be the ones that are less likely to recidivate, and that's pretty much because of the availability. So the alcohol offenders, since it's sociably acceptable and legal, they tend to be less successful after the program. But I'd say if I had to put a number on the percentage of completion, a success rate for completing the program, I'd say it's upwards about 95%. And most, and then you also asked about the commonality or when people may get that moment where they realize that they need that help. I think that having that peer-to-peer component and having those process groups where some of us addicts have hit our rock bottom can share with those that haven't quite hit it yet so that they get some enlightenment on what's ahead. And that's a big piece, is some of them haven't suffered all of the negative severe consequences that some of us have. And so when we're doing those groups, we share that with them. That's a big part.
Representative Vance had a question.
Yes, thank you. My questions are around kind of along the same thread, and I just may have missed this earlier, but I was just trying to get a picture of the timeline of how long the program is and what kind of oversight is there for continuing. Like you said, there's that, you know, light switch moment. You know, what's the process to get that extended so that you know that the individual is getting the most effective time for them? Can you give us a picture of what that might look like?
Sure, that's an excellent question, because it's an 18-month long requirement for the alcohol court, the DUI court, and it's a 12-month course, 12-month timeline for drug offenses, and a continuum of care is really needed, and because after all the oversight and the accountability is gone from after graduation, there needs to be, I believe, and what we've been trying to achieve is offering some sort of continuum of care for the participants so that they don't fall off and they bridge that gap from the court system back into their own sustaining the gain, if you will. So I was thinking that collaborating with the Department of Corrections and the probation office, that after completion of the program, that there's a requirement for a four-month time frame for them graduates to continue participating in the alumni group or some sort of accountability. And so I've talked with probation, I've talked with the prosecutors, and we're trying to see how we can implement a way of putting that in their Rule 11s as a requirement to continue overseeing them so that it's not such a sudden drop off. Mm-hmm. That's a big part.
Do you know why there's a shortened time period for drug versus alcohol? That doesn't make sense in my mind.
I don't know. I don't know why.
It didn't for me either. I don't know
why. One more follow-up. So for, you know, Mr. Roll, you mentioned that a PO could contend for someone. Is it at their level that they would request an additional time? Is, you know, what's that process?
Not quite sure I'm understanding.
Well, if there's an individual who needs additional time within the program,
it usually shows itself. What I mean by they need more time is sometimes people relapse in the program, mm-hmm. and then you get extended for sure. Different sanctions. Sometimes people self-destruct for a moment, you know, and it gets noticed by the whole team, and of course your time gets extended, and sometimes you get sent back to treatment, or you get sent back to, you know, like phase one for a little while to try and reset where you're coming from, instead of course the alternative to jail time.
All right, thank you.
Representative Christ Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taylor, you're talking about the peer-to-peer component and how important that is. Is that baked in deeply into the structure of the program as the court system operates the therapeutic courts?
Yes, it has been. Once we, the alumni group, came into fruition, they've adopted that as part of the program. And I think just nationally, it's being recognized as a important component. They should have that peer-to-peer assistance, if you will.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Yeah, this really makes me think whether we should draft a committee bill ensuring that the state maintain therapeutic court availability commensurate with demand, and perhaps we should talk with Chair Klayman about that. Representative Christ Hopkins.
And just a comment, Mr. Chair. I've heard a lot of data, you know, prior to today about how the recidivism rate is much lower in the therapeutic court system. And I mean, given that it's also 1/6 the cost of incarceration, in years prior in this committee, we've talked a lot about pay for success or social impact bonds. And I mean, the whole notion of that policy tool is if you have something that is proven and there's data backing it, that it creates better long-term social outcomes, even if it requires upfront social costs, that the economics of it work. And I mean, given that this is a proven system, and it seems like the limiting factor is the number of spots available and maybe awareness of that it's an option to people, which is that's a policy thing that we can work on and should be able to fix. It makes me wonder whether there's sort of a financial tool that could scale the program's availability.
Representative Story.
Along those lines, it makes me wonder, and I know how when you look at a departmental budget, that things can be tight, but it just makes me wonder if there's a way to look at those dollars and how they're being spent and to somehow funnel them more into proven programs that we know are working and maybe quit doing another program that has maybe not had the success or moved money around. And of course that would be, you know, we hope every department is looking at those things at all times, but it certainly is all these options I think we should be checking into.
Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On that topic, I think from the public's perspective is that the assumption is that our Department of Corrections is doing this type of program within the correctional system. We assume that that they're going to get the treatment and the help and the support that they need, and that's simply not happening for one reason or another. And so I think the public is left with this false expectation that a lot of the issues that got people into the system were resolved when they come out on the other side. And so helping provide direction, you know, to, you know, when someone is first addressed with these problems, that obviously they have more options and that this is the better one, I think is something that has been discussed. But we obviously need to provide specific directives on how we want to do that, and hopefully partner with Department of Corrections in past directives that Rep. Fields has begun to outline in the last crime bill. You know, it's unfortunate that it's taken us this long to be able to say, hey, we clearly need to be doing something. How did we not implement these things earlier? And I just want to say thank you again for coming and sharing your testimony. And it's something that I think that you two can be proud of. I know that there's an element of shame with addiction, but I think you can let that shame go and be proud that your process of getting to the place that you are is being used as a tool to help other people in an incredible way, and that's something to be very, very proud of. So thank you for helping us know how we can provide better policy.
Representative Grace Hopkins.
Did you both fly down from Anchorage for this hearing?
Yes, we did. Wow. Well, we were also here for other purposes, just to meet with our legislators. We do it annually.
Yeah.
Just share our stories and just and allow you all to see that it does work, that there are some successes. So we appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I just, sorry, one last comment. I mean, I think it's very clear from the stories you shared. You've gone through a hell of a lot more probably than most people in this building. And mm-hmm. I think a lot more resilience and grit and endurance for life. So thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
We're gonna take we're gonna transition to Department of Corrections. And Ms. Brooks, maybe we could just pick up. Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease as we do this transition. House State Affairs. Thanks, Ms. Brooks and Ms. Winkleman, for rejoining us to continue through this presentation, which I thought engendered really fantastic discussion before, so I appreciate your time and coming back. And I think we're on slide 11, perhaps.
For the record, my name is Laura Brooks. I'm the Division Manager for Health and Rehabilitation Division for the Department of Corrections.
And for the record, my name is Jen Winkleman, and I am the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
So thank you for having us back. This presentation, we were asked to put together through House Bill 49 to put together a report for the legislature that covers our rehabilitative programs and goes into the statewide efforts for reentry. And last time we talked about substance abuse treatment programs, mental health, and some of the other programs, and I believe we left off with our vocational programs. So I will just move forward with the remaining slides. The vocational programs that we have through the Department of Corrections, lack of employment is another one of the criminogenic needs that we talked about last time. It's a factor that contributes to recidivism. So we know that having these types of programs available to our offender population is a really, really integral part of their rehabilitation. So the slide that you have in front of you is just a sampling of some of the programs that we provide. We have vocational program coordinators in all of our facilities that they work on making sure that our offender population has a pretty wide variety of vocational programs available to them. They're chosen based on inmate interest, based on instructor availability, based on the size of the facility, and also we look at the Department of Labor's occupational forecast to try to make sure that the programs that we're offering meet the needs of the offender, meet the needs of Alaska, and that we're constantly reviewing these programs to make sure that we are providing the appropriate programs to the right offender at the right time. So some of these that you see here, they may be a day. It may take them a day to get a certificate, or it may be a year or 2 year long program that they complete while they're in custody. So last year we had about 2,400 individuals get some type of trade certification while they were in custody.
Representative Story has a question. I also have some questions on the slide.
Yes. At what point do you put down an information like three people took plumbing? 2 years later after they've been out, they're employed, how many took Flagler certification, just whatever these different ones are, because then I think that would give feedback back if you need to, like, switch to, like, we know we're going to need a whole bunch of CNAs or healthcare workers, and how does the current needs influence the class offerings?
Through the chair to Representative Story, that is something that we are continuing to develop a review process for. It's been very difficult. We work with the Department of Labor, of course, to try to track that. But there isn't currently a mechanism in place where we can definitively say that an individual who completed the barber program, for example, when they got out, they actually were employed in that field. We can say whether they were employed or not employed, but there's no mechanism other than through our probation offices and also then through our education coordinators who try to keep in contact with those offenders. So a lot of it is anecdotal information. But what we are really looking at, again, are those trends. And working with the Department of Labor, we rely on a lot of their evaluations and a lot of their recommendations to let us know what are the types of programs that would meet the needs of our offender population.
Follow-up?
Yes.
I believe we talked a little bit about this before, starting on this slide, and that's looking at the field of computer, IT, computer programming. And it doesn't seem to be on here, and it's such a huge place. And then I guess it would be, I don't know if there is a document that says how many people took each of these things listed.
Through the chair to Representative Story, yes, we do keep rosters for each one of the classes as to how many folks completed the class. So we do keep track of that. As far as the computer skills, that is one of the core programs that we are putting in place under the education group. So although We have a whole host of vocational programs. We also do have education programs, and that is one that we are working also to expand. We have some basic computer skills programs in place right now, and we are looking at that because, as you say, that's obviously an important field in this day and age. So that is absolutely an area that we're looking to expand.
I've got a question related to placement and jobs and kind of leveraging the power of employer associations. So I know that the operating engineers and the iron workers have apprenticeship programs at Highland, and some of the ladies have had just amazing success entering those apprenticeships. And I wonder, has the department tried to work with, you know, ABC is the non-union multi-employer apprenticeship program. Has the department talked to ABC about whether, you know, non-union apprenticeship programs could also provide placement for people? I mean, returning citizens work in a wide variety of construction jobs. And a related question, lots of our Alaska Native regional corporations and village corporations have some of their largest subsidiaries in the construction industry, both union and non-union. And has the department done kind of a scan of Alaska Native Corporation shareholders to see, you know, gosh, we've got a shareholder in this facility, they're going to be exiting at this time, they've taken construction training, you know, if it's an Aetna shareholder, Aetna has these companies that work in construction, they've got a shareholder mandate. It just seems to me that, you know, the model that the operating engineers and the iron workers developed could be extended beyond those trades and beyond union apprenticeships to more generally leverage multi-employer associations and some of our largest employers, which are the Alaska Native regional corporations. Could you talk about that and the department's capacity to kind of formalize those linkages?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we do have a number of partnerships related to these programs. And in our facilities, we have, again, our education coordinators and our institutional probation officers, and then our field probation officers are some of our strongest linkages to make sure that the individuals through that offender management program that I talked about last time, through that, once they have completed a class, that they do have those opportunities and they do have those linkages to employers in the community. We had, through a grant, we had a job specialist through the Department of Labor that was placed at one of our facilities with incredible success. That individual placed about 130 women out of Highland Mountain with jobs during the time period that they were there. That was a grant that is no longer in existence, but we have partnered again with the Department of Labor to put job specialists back into our facilities. And actually, we already have one back at Highland Mountain. Not full-time like we had before, but we're working towards that because that is a critical piece. As you said, once they have that skill, making sure that they know where to go, that they know the employers that will hire them, that they know what's available to them in the community, so then they can actually use that skill.
That's great. What would be the cost of having a Department of Labor staff person full-time in every facility?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the cost to place an individual there off the top of my head, but that is a discussion that we've had with the Department of Labor.
I would appreciate hearing back on that and consideration of including it in next year's operating budget request, or I guess we could think about it through legislation, but I just don't know how we coordinate that connection to employment without having someone do it. And there are so many of these larger employers and associations where we should coordinate. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I have just a question on process. So with this job specialist that you've had that helped find the placement, is that something that they were able to get the employment relatively quickly? Like, what's the process on, okay, they get out of prison, you know, they begin, you know, they find housing, they get a job, or like, can you just help me with that with the value that this job specialist helped make this connection?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, it really varies depending on the trade that the program that they went through. But what oftentimes those job specialists do is they sit down with that individual who as they're going through the classes, maybe even as they're determining which classes to go into. They're working to try to make sure that that's a good fit. And as those individuals get closer to release, they are looking for employers in the community and trying to determine where could that individual go, and even trying to figure out how we can make that quote-unquote warm handoff, that this here's an employer that's actually expecting you. Here's where you go. And that then, of course, is in collaboration with the other job skills programs that we provide to the individuals while they're in custody, resume writing, interview skills, those types of things, all come in tandem with that, so that then when they leave with that certificate in hand, they're prepared not just to work the job, but also to maintain that job, become a good employee, be a good interviewee, so on and so forth.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like step one was figuring out the connection. Okay, someone's leaving incarceration. They go to Partners for Progress. They search for a job, but really a more refined model would be they leave incarceration, they have a job lined up. And I mean, that is possible, but it takes an additional level of coordination. I wanted to ask, my sense is that some of these programs are more active at certain institutions than others. Could you give us a little bit of the flavor of, you know, which ones are particularly popular or well-staffed? I mean, some of these rely on pretty skilled instructors at different institutions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. So a lot of it depends, again, on even the size of the facility. Obviously, at Goose Creek, we're going to be able to run a number of really robust trades programs simply by virtue of the size of the facility and the space that we have versus, say, Anvil Mountain or Fairbanks, because of the space, and also because those are also have a very large pretrial population. So a place like Spring Creek, Wildwood, Highland, and Goose Creek, those are places that have longer term prisoners. They are the primarily sentenced populations. So they are better positioned to have those types of programs.
If I could just do one follow up and then we'll go to Representative Vance. Could you talk about some specific facilities where there are strong programs and, you know, what enables that success at those facilities for those programs?
Sure, Mr. Chair. One of the popular programs that we have at Goose Creek is the barber program. We have an inmate now who runs actually and teaches that class out there. That's been very popular. We're now replicating that in Wildwood, and then we'll bring that into Spring Creek as well. Another one is the mobile welding class. There is a truck that goes to a number of our facilities, and it has welding units in the truck. It's a Sealand type, you know, truck. And the individuals go through a program there, and they get hands-on work welding in that truck. And then we have a couple of facilities that also have welding simulators where they can work on their skill throughout the year. Then when the truck comes back with those contractors and those instructors, they've had opportunities to practice and really able to hone that skill. So they're able to go out, and we have agreements, partnerships with the iron workers and so forth. So as a matter of fact, a couple of the individuals who run that mobile welding truck were formerly incarcerated individuals. So that has been met with, you know, great enthusiasm, and those classes are always full.
On the building maintenance apprenticeship, as I recall, that was an apprenticeship that the DOC started itself with the Department of Labor a number of years back. Am I remembering that correctly, and what's the status of that program?
Mr. Chair, that is not a program I'm as familiar with, so I'd have to get back with you on that.
Okay, and one more follow-up before we go to Representative Vance. Mm-hmm. Thanks for bearing with me. Has the department looked at its power of procurement to support these programs? So if you've got, you know, an employer association, a trade union like the iron workers that employs returning citizens, in your own contracting, do you try to provide incentives, opportunities for firms that employ returning citizens to in turn work on your facilities to kind of drive that market and make more opportunities available for returning citizens?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that it's written into our actual procurement, but we absolutely have been able to forge that type of relationship through the instructors, through the individuals who come into our facilities, and they then in turn work with those offenders just by virtue of their familiarity with them to make sure, or to do everything they can to try to make sure that they have those opportunities when they release. The Department of Labor does have a fidelity bonding program and also a federal tax credit that are available to employers to try to encourage them to hire some more at-risk employees.
Okay. Well, I guess I would just ask that y'all, you know, consider good incentives in your procurement for, hey, companies that employ returning citizens coming directly out of incarceration are going to have an advantage when they bid on, you know, repairs and renovations of the facilities. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. for the job training and assistance from the job specialist, is that for ones who have received sentencing or for all inmates?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, there are programs that are available for the pretrial population. It most likely depends on the length of the program, because obviously sometimes that's very limiting. So if somebody is looking at a year-long program and they're pretrial, they're probably not, they may go on the wait list, but they will be farther down on the wait list as opposed to somebody who has a year more to serve.
Thank you.
Do other members have questions on this slide? I do, but I've asked many. Okay. I know seafood employment has been a major area of employment of both inmates and returning citizens. What is the current status of seafood employment partnerships at different facilities?
Mr. Chair, so we are working on right now to identify a pool of offenders who will be eligible to go out and work in the canneries this next season. So I am not familiar with how many we have online for that, but there is a pretty good demand for that. And they're, through a couple of partnerships, they have absolutely stepped forward and have been very willing to take our population into their program.
Is that limited to communities in which there's both a correctional facility and a processing plant, or has the department figured out how to, say, allow inmates to be dispatched to some of the more remote processing facilities that are not in the same community as the facility?
Mr. Chair, I know that when we're looking at the pool of offenders eligible for that, we're looking at them statewide. So for the seafood plant in Kenai, for example, or Soldotna area, wouldn't necessarily have to come from our Wildwood facility.
Got it. And do you know offhand if there are processing plants in King Salmon, Naknek, out the Aleutians that are employing returning citizens, and is that the kind of thing where the department's been able to work with processors to employ, you know, kind of a large group of inmates or returning citizens in those facilities and get around whatever hurdles might otherwise exist in terms of returning to meet parole officers and so on?
Mr. Chair, I'm not that familiar with that. I don't know. We could certainly check on that and get back with you on what that status is. I know there's been interest across the state from a number of places.
Okay. Thanks for answering all those questions.
Comment on that point.
Representative Christ Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment on that point, which is it's always seemed to me with sort of undersupply of labor for seafood processing and looking at J-1 visas and importing people from Bulgaria and lower 40. I mean, like, the process is really hurting, and it's hard work, but it also pays well with the overtime, and it feels like there's some synergy there. And I was really interested and excited when that nascent partnership with DOC and processors was happening a year or two ago, and would love to see if there's a way we can support that going forward.
I totally agree, and you know, I think there can be a model where it is absolutely cheaper for processors, because my understanding is you're not going to get a J-1 visa worker without spending upwards of $5,000 per person. So if it's possible to have dozens of inmates working at facilities that are in Naknek, King Salmon, and the Aleutians, and they're able to retain some of those savings, which smooths their transition back into the community when they're released, that would just be such a win for the state, both in terms of the inmates and the processors. Representative Vance, and then Story.
Thank you. Along that line, the University of Alaska, you know, is offering courses on seafood processing and things, and is trying to generate more activity into that, because the amount of non-residents working in the seafood processing is extremely large. Do you have partnerships with the university in some of the programs that such as seafood processing that you normally wouldn't be in your wheelhouse? Do you have any kind of partnerships with that to be able to kind of fill the need and provide for jobs?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, we don't for seafood. There are some college programs that are available to our offender population. Mostly that's that is self-study programs that then we will offer, you know, tutoring to try to help them get through that. We do have an agreement with Ilisavik College, so they do some work with our women at Highland, but we don't have anything that is specific to the seafood industry.
All right, thank you.
I think Representative Story had a question or comment.
Yeah, just follow up on the seafood industry. I just needed clarification. Has that program started? Are we still trying to get it up and going? And if it has started, what is the number of people who have participated?
So through the chair to Representative Story, we did have some offenders go out last year with some mixed success. We have been working to identify offenders who are eligible to go out. It's been a little bit difficult for kind of a variety of reasons. And we're also trying to fill our CRC slots, and it's the same population. Our electronic monitoring, it's the same population. Much of that is competing interests for that. And to be quite frank, some of our offenders are not interested in working in the seafood industry because, as you indicated, it is very hard work. And so we are now working to try to build that pool so that when that plant is ready, we will have a group that is ready to go. Because they certainly, as you say, they're very interested in our population. We're trying to encourage folks to apply for that. We're trying to build up interest and identify those who would be eligible. Because as you said, it's good money for them to have.
Well, that's great, because my understanding from talking to a lot of these HR folks with the processors is basically they'll employ as many people as they can get, and their challenge is having predictability of supply of workers entering a very busy season. So to the extent that we as the state can help meet that, they will be employed.
So DOC also provides many opportunities for our offenders in custody to find spiritual supports. We do have full-time chaplains, primarily provided by religious volunteers through Alaska Correctional Ministries. We have about 1,200 active religious volunteers. And so that they provide the chaplaincy services, they run specific chapel services, faith mods, and then our transitional living or transformational living communities, which is really an intensive faith-based residential program where it's a spiritual approach to addressing things like anger management, criminal thinking, addictions, things like that. So in addition to that, they run religious studies throughout our facilities and then are also just there for general spiritual support.
Question. Is there overlap between medication-assisted treatment and faith-based programs, or are those sort of separate tracks?
Mr. Chair, someone who is in the faith-based program certainly could participate in the medication-assisted treatment, but they are absolutely separate programs. We do have prison-based domestic violence programs. DOC partners with the Department of Public Safety and the and CDVSA, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. So right now we are engaged in a comprehensive review of the domestic violence programming because, again, as I talked about last time, our focus really is on making sure that the programs that we offer are evidence-based, that they're being delivered, you know, to fidelity of the model, so on and so forth. And so we are working with CDVSA right now to do a pretty exhaustive review of the curriculum that's currently being used. And so right now those prison-based programs are only available in three of our facilities, Goose Creek, Lemon Creek, and Fairbanks Correctional Center. And once that review is complete and we move forward with a new curriculum, we are hoping to expand that so that that's available in every one of our facilities because the need is certainly there. And we recognize that. On slide 14, this kind of gives you an idea of our sex offender management programs. As I'm sure you all are aware, Alaska has the highest rate of sexual assault in the country, and about 15% of DOC's population are on sexual crimes. So we have worked very hard to build up these programs, and we increased enrollment last year by about 25%. So we are moving forward with that. You can see our institutional sex offender treatment programs. We have those in five of our institutions. There's about 88 slots for treatment in our facilities. We have about 30 on that wait list. Really, that wait list should probably be quite a bit longer, but our offender population, quite frankly, prefers to wait until they get out of custody and engage in the treatment programs that are in the community. So we have about 240 slots in the communities and a wait list out in our communities of about 80. About a little over a year ago, we started a video-based treatment program So what that does is we have a mental health clinician based in Anchorage who provides sex offender treatment to offenders who return to rural communities so that they can remain in their home communities instead of returning to a larger urban area for their sex offender treatment.
Representative Vance had a question.
Why do you think the inmates choose to wait to get treatment till they are outside of the facility?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I think there's a host of reasons. They're not required by the court to participate in in-custody treatment. And there's a stigma associated with being a sex offender in custody. And so many of these programs are, our high-risk offender program is a residential program, and it's intensive. And they live on a MOD, and they go through treatment, and they are a part of treatment every day. If you wait until you are out in the community, we don't have residential sex offender treatment programs in the community, so it's a very different model. And for some, that's much more appealing. And really, in all reality, a big part of that, we believe, is related to the stigma of being a sex offender in custody.
Follow up. Do you have any sense on which model is more successful?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I don't have those numbers separated out. What I can tell you is that we operate under the containment model. So once an individual is released from custody, there's a specially trained probation officer. They engage in treatment, cognitive behavioral treatment, and they undergo polygraphs. And so individuals who have gone through that program, their recidivism rate is for sexual crimes is under 5%. And so the containment model, and that's in keeping with the recidivism rate for sex offenders nationally who also are under that containment model. So that's a very successful model. That is the national gold standard for sex offender maintenance and treatment nationally.
I'm sorry, was that after?
That's for once they get released.
Yes, with the probation officer.
Right.
Okay.
And so our recidivism, the way we define and have to track recidivism is 3 years post-release. That's how statutorily it's defined. So once somebody has been out of custody for 3 years, that's when we look at their recidivism. And so for a non-sex offender, the recidivism rate is 59.9%. So someone who has been through the containment model, that's dropped to 5%.
Follow up. How long is this containment model?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, it depends. It is based on the treatment provider's recommendation in collaboration with the probation officer to determine once somebody is treatment complete. There are goals that are set up throughout treatment, and once they achieve those goals, the treatment team meets and makes a determination to determine that they're treatment complete.
Follow up. Are there similarities between what we just heard, the testimony of the wellness, I forget the word.
The wellness court?
The wellness court and this model that you're talking about, you know, with the treatment and accountability. I'm just trying to get a sense of, I think all of us are trying to get a sense of what's the most effective way to help people who need treatment, who have been incarcerated. And it sounds like we have the wellness court that's a very successful model. We have this for sex offenders that's a successful model, and then there's this huge swath of people in between that are not getting what they need. So do you identify similarities in the programs that would speak to success?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, one of the most effective models for reducing recidivism is putting individuals through cognitive behavioral treatment. But the difficulty with that, quite frankly, in our system is only about 25% of our population get out on probation and parole. So that leaves a huge amount of our offender population for whom there is no requirement to participate either in substance abuse treatment, sex offender treatment, finish education, or anything like that. So that is a big challenge. So that's why we are working so hard to build up our programs in custody to make sure that when we have them literally as a captive audience, we can make sure that they have those opportunities. The challenge with that, I will tell you, is that we can't force them to participate in those programs. So we do try to incentivize those programs. We try to, through the offender management program, our institutional probation officers, our education coordinators, anyone who works in the facilities tries to encourage these folks to participate in those programs. And hearing success stories like we heard today is a very powerful tool. So one of the areas that we're trying to build up is peer mentorships and peer support programs so that individuals who have been successful in the recovery process or been successful in the reentry process can come back in and also participate in that encouragement and trying to direct folks or lead folks in that direction.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you for the opportunity. So is the reason that there isn't a requirement to participate is because it violates freedoms, or are there specific ones that are court-ordered? Can you help?
Sure.
Give me a feel of why you can't mandate certain treatment.
Through the chair to Representative Vance. So it depends. So, for example, sex offender treatment, if you're convicted of a sex offense in this state, you're required to participate in sex offender treatment. There are some substance-related cases where they are court-ordered to substance abuse treatment. If there's not a court order in place, it may be put in place by the parole board. But short of that, for example, education is not something that the court orders someone, you know, to participate in. So it has to be, there has to be that intrinsic motivation to do that. And there isn't really a mechanism in place for, or there is no ability on behalf of the Department of Corrections to force somebody to go to that class. We just can't require them to do that. And oftentimes, you know, unfortunately, we just have folks who tell us they're just not interested. And so the best that we can do is we offer it. We try to make it attractive to them and encourage them. But at the end of the day, if there's not a court order, it's not something that we can require.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Story.
Follow up to that. I thought that we had put into a policy that people very highly motivate people to go into treatment if they can get some credit for time served. Like if you, I know, I remember we had changed it. It used to be, it wasn't a one for one day, but it was quite significant. And then we changed it, maybe one for three. And I don't know in how many areas we do that, but to me, looking at that closely and looking at that policy seems to be so smart, because then people will be very highly motivated if they get some time off served to attend these programs. Can someone give me the history of what we did legislatively recently?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Why do I have this memory of us working on that with our programs before? Dreamed it?
I don't have an answer to that
okay.
either. I do have a question, though. As I recall, the Department of Health and Social Services was working on a peer support certification and supporting peer support in a variety of contexts. Has DOC worked with the department to bring more peer support into facilities, or do you have other updates on that effort?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Department of Health and Social Services is working on a peer certification program to make sure that folks who are interested in participating in this type of work have the appropriate training, have necessary training, and then they'll get a certificate to verify that. There are paid positions in the community right now, but right now we have been working with the Department of Health and Social Services. I know it's progressing. I'm not exactly sure where they are in that process. There is an agency out of Fairbanks that does that training right now. And so they are in the process of certifying folks. It's not one that is DHSS approved, but it still requires their peer support folks to go through a training process.
Is that RAID Act?
Mr. Chair, I'm not
okay.
Positive.
No problem.
I'm not positive.
Thanks. Representative Story.
Yes, you had told us where we had domestic violence programs and what facilities. How about in our sex offender management program? Where do we have those?
Certainly. Through the chair to Representative Story, our sex offender treatment programs in custody are located in Goose Creek, Lemon Creek, Anvil Mountain, Wildwood, and Highland Mountain. We have a program, a gender-specific program for women sex offenders, female sex offenders.
Thank you.
So the department also has a series of pro-social and give-back programs. A busy inmate is a safer inmate. And I know that some of these programs sometimes seem a little bit frivolous, but that really has been found to be true. If we can keep them occupied and we can keep them busy, less time to get into trouble, not unlike our teenagers. So engaging in healthy pro-social activities is also a really important part of the rehabilitative effort. So what you see on this slide also is just a small sampling of what our education coordinators, our POs, and our superintendents work on to bring into our facilities. So things like yoga and running and basketball, you know, those are life skills. That's teaching them healthy living, healthy communication through maybe a book club or some other kind of club organization like that. Quilting and hobby craft, we have that in some of our facilities. You know, that really teaches them about concentrating and being able to focus. And in addition to that, for the first time, they're building something, they're creating something, and they're finishing something. And so being able to have our offender population come together and create something is really an incredibly powerful thing to watch. And just having them have that self-satisfaction of realizing of what they actually can do and what positive work they actually can do. And then, you know, we also have some canine programs. So there's that whole idea of unconditional positive regard. And again, being able to train something and have that, again, that feeling of accomplishment. So we also have a number of give back programs where they're putting someone else first, maybe for the first time in their life, they're putting someone else first. It's an opportunity to give something back to the community and grow that self-worth. Some of these projects also have deeply personal meaning to our offenders, and that can be very therapeutic. So creative writing classes, we have people come in from the community. We have university professors who've come in and led creative writing classes. The Lullaby Project at Highland Mountain is a project where it pairs inmates with musicians, and they write a lullaby to their child, and then that gets burned onto a CD, and they're able to send that to their child. So there are a number of programs like that, and most of that is done through the special interests of our staff at the facilities. It's something where they know somebody in the community, and so it's a volunteer that comes in to do something like that. We have offenders who knit Christmas stockings at the holidays and give it to the foster kids in their community. They do woodworking at Goose Creek or at Highland or at Wildwood, and they make wooden toys and give those away. So these pro-social activities are also really an integral part of that rehabilitative effort and addressing the criminogenic needs for developing pro-social attitudes, pro-social peers, and pro-social activities for when they get out.
Yeah, I've heard incredibly positive things about some of these programs, and you know, another worthwhile attribute of them is they allow folks who are not in incarceration to positively engage with people who are, which is really important as we think about reentry. Representative Hopkins had a question.
Yeah, on that note, I have some very, very good friends, lifelong friends who've known me longer than I've known me, my parents' friends, involved in that creative writing program up in Fairbanks, and I know how impactful it's been. Mm-hmm. On the book clubs, along those same lines, another one of my constituents in Fairbanks has been going around and collecting private donations to get newspapers into the Fairbanks Correctional Center because there's simply no access to the news at all about what's happening outside, similar to reentry concerns. How are you guys getting those books? Are they in a library there? Are they donated? And what else are you doing to, I guess, what can you do to expand newspaper access within our correctional facilities?
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, we do have libraries in our facilities, and that's the inmates have access to those. So that's where those would be placed.
Is that a state-funded library? Obviously, it's through you guys. So
I believe most of the books that are in those libraries are donated okay. Throughout our system.
So it's not a follow-up. Sorry, it's not a line item for you guys funding that library or that space or anything like that.
So that, through the chair to represent, that's correct. We do, of course, have through our education programs, you know, the GED testing programs and those or the GED testing books and things like that. Those are funded through our education program, but the types of books that are found in the library, those are donated.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Story.
Yes, we had some highly successful programs. Our Northwest Coast Arts Program at the Lemon Creek facility here, which was sponsored by Sea Alaska Heritage, did a lot of funding for it. And then also our Flying University program, which had gone for several years. And it's my understanding both of them have stopped. And my explanation that I heard was due to overcrowding. The area where they did the Northwest Coast Arts wasn't available, and I don't know why the Flying University stopped, but I would really appreciate some follow-up on that, because if there's any way to have those re-happen and clarify my information, I would just really strongly urge that, because there was such positive feedback that I'd heard on those. Thank you.
So the last section of the report addressed reentry, and you know, reentry really is the process that helps offenders return to our communities, successfully resume family community responsibilities, and it's really not a new concept. We now have reentry coalitions, we have reentry events like the simulations that we talked about, reentry inreach, grant funding focused on reentry, but it's really not a new concept. Our probation officers, our mental health clinicians, our ed coordinators, they've been doing it really for a very long time. But now there's a word for it, and it's really gained a lot of attention, which I want to be clear that it's not a buzzword. And somebody told me not too long ago that we need to really stop calling it a program and start practicing as a philosophy. And that really is what we are trying to do. It's not just a word. This is what the offender management plan from day one builds toward, is that successful reentry and returning these folks to the community. So, and given that the fact that 95% of our population return to the community, we really have an obligation that we take very seriously to make sure that when they do return, they return better than when they came to us in the first place, and that there's somebody waiting for them in the community to pick up that baton and keep that moving forward with them. So this slide is just kind of a general overview of what you'll find in that report. But there's a whole host of reentry efforts that are going on now. The Second Chance Act grants, the Department of Corrections has $1 million grant that with the option to continue that for 2 additional years. And that's really been an incredible opportunity for us to help develop a sustainable approach and establishing policies and practices to improve our recidivism outcomes. And so we have dedicated reentry probation officers now who work with the offenders while they're still in the facility to help transition them from the institutional probation officer work out into the community and make sure that that offender management plan follows them and that there are those supports for them. And that grant also then provides things as simple as transportation, maybe clothing vouchers, housing vouchers, whatever that individual might need in order to really get on their feet for those first few months that's so critical when they first walk out of our doors. There are a number of second chance grants that have been awarded in Alaska. There are, and so we are collaborating with the other agencies that also have those to make sure that they have access to what they need to make the most of those opportunities. We do have a couple of mental health programs, the IDP Plus and the APIC programs. You'll see those. Those are actually reentry programs that have been in place for a very long time. And those are specific to our mentally ill population, so that individuals who suffer from serious mental illness and or cognitive disabilities have a very structured release plan when they walk out the door. They have a place to live. They have access to their medications. They have case management. They have Medicaid. And so those are programs that are continuing with support from the Mental Health Trust. We're working on things like increasing case management access to our facilities. That's a real critical piece. We have an RFP out on the street right now for a reentry coordinator for substance abuse, so that when somebody does complete the substance abuse programs in custody, they have a connection right away, so that when they leave our facilities, they have a connection to aftercare out in the community. Or if somebody hasn't been able to go through a substance abuse treatment program in custody, but they were able to get an assessment, that there will be a case manager that can then guide them to a program in the community. Reentry centers, reentry coalitions, I think you are all fairly familiar with those. They are doing some really great community inreach projects where the reentry coalitions are working with community providers to come into our facilities and have kind of what would be the equivalent of a job fair, only it's like a reentry fair. Here are some of the resources that are available to you. Again, meeting an individual face-to-face so that they know who to go to when they walk out of our facilities.
Ms. Brooks represents, we had a question.
Yes, I'm wondering who coordinates with the agencies for the reentry program in the department or the division, who is making sure they're working with our partner organizations like Clinkett and Haida through their reentry programs and the Juno Reentry Coalition, who sets aside that time to make sure we're a web of support.
Through the chair to Representative Story. So right now we have one position in the division that is our overall reentry coordinator. We have in our budget for this year put in a request for, I think it's about $740,000 to really stand up a reentry unit and add additional staff to that because that is exactly an area where we need to have more collaboration and more organization so that we can prioritize the needs, we can work with our community partners to make sure, number one, we're not double dipping, we're not doing double duty, making sure that, you know, no area is over-resourced because of a variety of reasons that we've run into already. So that's what we're working on right now, is standing up an actual unit within this division to make sure that those very things are being addressed.
And that's currently in the budget as it stands in House Finance?
That's great. Correct, Mr. Thank Chair. You.
Representative Vance has a question.
I have a very unrelated question, but it has to do with reentry, and I just wanting to know exactly what happens. But one of the things that I heard when I visited Spring Creek was that when people get released, they essentially get a bus ticket, and if they're likely from, you know, Anchorage, that they're kind of on their own to get there, but on a weekly, regular basis, there's buses bringing inmates in, and the frustration that was expressed to me was, why aren't we helping those people who are reentering get a bus ride back to the community so that they're not feeling stranded, that they kind of have to create that first step on their own? Is that an accurate, or has that been resolved?
Through the chair to Representative Vance. So if you're speaking about Spring Creek, the bus that they're referring to is actually a correctional bus. We don't release folks to Spring Creek or to Seward unless that was where they were arrested. So we have an obligation, we have actually a statutory requirement to return people to their point of arrest, wherever that may be in the state. So Spring Creek is one of those facilities, because it's for long-term offenders. They're there from every possible community around Alaska, and we do take them back to their point of arrest. And that may require a correctional bus from Spring Creek to Anchorage. We then, you know, provide them with an airline ticket back to their home community. So I'm not sure that the information you have is exactly accurate. That's just what I can tell you about Spring Creek, but that's actually true for any of our facilities. Wherever they're located, we will make sure they get back. We will give them the opportunity to get back to their point of arrest.
Follow up. So with your experience in this, do you, and I obviously don't know the background between the term the point of arrest versus the person's residence, because the whole point of positive reentry is that they're going to be connected back to their community, that they can meet their probation, they can get employment and housing. Have you heard reports, is there a differential between being returned to the point of arrest versus a word that would more reflect their home community? Because obviously that's kind of our policy call, and if that's something that needs to be adjusted for more successful reentry, I think that might be one of those things that is slipping through the cracks.
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I don't have any kind of numbers on that. We could see what we could find out for that. But generally speaking, the individuals are returned to their, what we call their home community now. But that is going to be their point of arrest.
Yeah, I would follow up, invite the department to come back to us with suggestions for how to revise that. And perhaps it would be point of arrest or the resident's home at the discretion of perhaps the returning citizen. I'd be interested in what the department thinks about that.
So just for follow-up, this for the record, my Jen Wingleman, Acting Deputy Commissioner for Department of Corrections. I the one thing I would just add with regard to point of arrest is that folks will have the choice of where they go as well. So we have an obligation to take them back to their point of arrest, but we often will see them waive that and want to stay in the community, their family, especially if you have somebody that has been incarcerated for a long period of time and their family may have moved or relocated. So that's part of it, but we have a statutory obligation to return them to their point of arrest should that be where they want to go.
In that case, I guess I have a follow-up question. So let's say someone from Fairbanks was arrested in Anchorage and detained at Spring Creek. Will the department pay to return them to Fairbanks rather than just Anchorage if that's where they want to go back upon return?
To the chair, I am not certain on that.
But we have someone here who is.
Okay.
To the chair, when it is in the best interest of the state, we will return them back to the Fairbanks in that case.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. So another piece that was required for the legislative report is to look at what services do we have that are just starting, that are moving forward. And we've touched on some of these already. But one of the things that we are working on is, as I mentioned before, is, you know, really looking at trying to fill our halfway house beds. And one of the things for this year is we are looking at a pilot halfway house that will be very reentry focused, very heavy on those programs. So individuals who are leaving our correctional facility but aren't quite yet ready to go back to the community will have an opportunity really to continue more of those programming needs within that halfway house. So looking at partnering with the Department of Labor to come in and do post-incarceration employment classes, other types of classes that maybe they weren't able to completely go through while they were incarcerated, making sure that they have the opportunity to complete that, whether it's GED classes or interview skills, whatever that might be, an intensive type of program there at a halfway house. So that's one of the things that is coming. We are standardizing our core curriculum throughout our facilities so that if somebody starts taking a program in Goose Creek and they transfer to Spring Creek, that it's much easier for them to pick that program up down there. Let's see, we have a fairly large project going on at Highland Mountain. It's remodeling a section of Highland Mountain to expand our mental health unit. And how that plays into reentry is, of course, we want to make sure that our most vulnerable populations have as much access to supports as possible. And so this is going to increase the number of beds available for our acutely mentally ill women, expand the program space so that we can, you know, we can make sure that we are providing them with as many supports as possible before they release. I did mention standing up the DOC reentry unit. We also are looking very much towards training opportunities for our staff, things like making sure our officers as well as our medical staff are trained in mental health first aid, trauma-informed care, crisis intervention models, because these are that's all part of that rehabilitative process, is making sure that our staff knows how to work with folks with disabilities or make sure they are taking the best approach to someone as they're escalating, because we need to be able to model that behavior for them. And so looking at how we can increase that training for our line staff. One of the things we hear continuously is how our offenders struggle to get substance abuse assessments when they get out or even when they're in custody. And so we have gone to a standardized software. It is the gold standard for the addictions field. It's called the Continuum software. And we just had our staff trained on that in the fall, and we're rolling that out now. It's a manualized program. It's a standardized assessment tool, and our hope is that we've also been working with Department of Health and Social Services, and the hope is that if we can get the community providers to recognize, you know, that this is really the gold standard for substance abuse assessments, it won't be required that they get another one as soon as they get out. And Health and Social Services has been looking at, is that something that they would have their treatment providers go to as well, so that it is the same, it's the same assessment tool. Because what happens right now is maybe Clitheroe is where this individual wants to go, but they had their assessment done at a different substance abuse treatment program, and so they don't accept those. So if we can standardize that throughout our system, that's really going to make that process much more efficient and easier to access. You had mentioned previously the medication-assisted program. We do have that within DOC, and the Department of Health and Social Services has a new pilot program in Anchorage that is focusing on increasing the number of folks receiving MAT services and expanding the treatment provider availability to that population as well. We do still hear that access to MAT treatment in rural communities is still very, very limited, so that's another focus for our departments to work on as well. Peer support certification, we did speak about that. Department of Education has been another partner with the Department of Corrections for funding for programs and education supports for our offender population. So we they've just let us know a week or so ago that there was another grant that they are going to be providing for us to expand some of our vocation programs and education programs within the department. So,
could you explain increased access through 1115 waiver?
Mr. Chair, I will try. That is a health and social services program where the Medicaid waiver allows greater access to substance abuse treatment and behavioral health treatment. So it's really it's anticipated that it will have a significant impact and make it much easier for our population as well as others to access that really critical treatment.
So I guess if I understand correctly, we're the 1115 waiver addressing this in the context of DOC would allow us to tap additional federal resources to provide substance abuse treatment to more people. Is that sort of what's happening?
Mr. Chair, once they get out in the community, custody, those programs are state funded, but once individuals come out into the community, sometimes their access is very limited, and so this will increase benefits and access to both mental health and substance abuse treatment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Vance has a question.
What is the percentage of the inmates who have mental health? I've heard that there's a high percentage of brain injury and also mental health. And with that question is the follow-up one is what kind of training does staff have? You kind of touched on that, but I want to kind of connect it to this one to work with people with mental illness.
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Vance, we have mental health clinicians in every one of our facilities. We have psychiatrists on staff. They're screened as soon as they come in. And we have approximately 65% of our population are what we call mental health trust beneficiaries. So they are individuals with a diagnosable mental health disorder, cognitive disability, or developmental delay. About 80% of our population have substance use disorders, and then about 20 to 22% of our population have what's called a serious and persistent mental illness, which would be something like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. In terms of the TBI population, that is really, really difficult to nail down a good number. And nationally, I've seen numbers for prison populations being anywhere from 15 to 87%. So that is such a wide disparity. It's really not a good number. But part of the difficulty with that is it's so often by self-report, and that self-report takes on a wide variety of things, from someone who lost consciousness in a major motor vehicle accident for 3 days to somebody who maybe got, you know, hit in the head with a baseball. So it's a very difficult number for us to track. What we look at instead is an individual's ability to function. And those are the individuals that may very often then, through our mental health clinicians, we are able to determine that they had a traumatic brain injury that's then affecting their ability to function.
Follow-up? So you have say one staffer, for instance, is all the staff that's working with the inmates on a regular basis, do they have training on how to work with people with mental illness?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, thank you for that reminder. So we, of course, have mental health clinicians psychiatric nurses, and then our medical staff. But also our officers receive in the training academy, they receive mental health training, they receive training on suicide prevention. And then we have, through funding from the Mental Health Trust Authority, we have funding to be able to do additional trainings for mental health. And so we have rolled out programs for mental health first aid, which is a general general overview of mental health in corrections and how that might manifest itself. And then trauma-informed care. And also recently we trained our staff, trained the trainers for CIT training, which is crisis intervention. You may have heard about that in through law enforcement in the community. Now there's a model for correctional crisis intervention teams. And so our officers were rolling that out last year and this year so that they can have additional training.
Thank you.
I think Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you. Yeah, and I was going to wait until you were done with slide 19, but we've only got a few minutes left in committee. So I wanted to hop onto the question I promised I would ask. Looking at probably page 8, the substance use disorder services, how can you let people know about the therapeutic courts while they're in jail as well and offering them these services?
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, I think that's a really good question. I wasn't personally aware that there was such a difficulty in accessing that program. I know that through the Public Defender's Office, they are often the primary conduit to recommend that program, and also through the judges themselves. I did pass on my cards to the gentleman who spoke here today, and we are absolutely happy if they have any kind of materials that we could post in our facilities. We'd be happy to push that forward. I think there's also opportunities through our substance abuse treatment programs and through our institutional probation officers and mental health clinicians to let folks know that that's an opportunity. We work very, very closely with the mental health courts. And so we have, that is an area where we regularly refer individuals to the mental health court. So I think that that's a real opportunity that we could do the same.
Thank you. I would love, I know time is money and you guys are swamped in what you have to do and budget cuts all the time. I would love to get a letter back from you guys about what the plan is going to be for implementing that, because money is also money. And if it's 1/6 the cost, getting just those few more beds open is going to open up a lot of available services for you guys. So I'd appreciate a letter back on how you'll make sure that that is implemented.
And on that point, I mean, I'm curious about the role of local police departments. I would guess in the case of arresting someone at a Home Depot, you know, who the Home Depot staff has seen this person 10 times stealing something, the police officer is probably aware they're stealing to feed an addiction. And what role do the police departments have? And, you know, does filling out the paperwork one way or another make a difference in terms of accessibility to the mental health or therapeutic courts? And is there a role for local police departments in helping route people in the most productive way? I don't know the answer to that and would appreciate the follow-up.
And actually, I think, the last slide here is the last part of the report. We requested feedback from other agencies and entities involved in reentry to try to identify some of the gaps that still exist. And so what you see on here are some of the things that have been identified as still needing improvement. And so this is part of what our reentry unit will absolutely start working on. We already have made inroads in some of these areas. And so these are some of the things that will be on our agenda in this coming year.
On one of these, I would really appreciate input on what is the delta between housing that reentrants are finding and housing that reentrants need? Because it seems that historically, through AHFC, we've kind of dealt with what I think people would describe as the chronically homeless population and the kind of incidentally homeless population who cycle through, and we need to meet those needs. But I don't know how much we've kind of tried to have AHFC-supported housing options meet capacity that is currently unmet among reentrants. And understanding that, I think, could be valuable as we look at the AHFC budget for housing and whether we need to sort of think about meeting an additional need on the premise that it's much less expensive than reincarcerating someone when they fail to find housing. Representative Vance.
Yes, just real quick, if I could have a follow-up on some steps that we might be able to take statutorily in regards to the
identification, the state ID, because we have the real ID that has obviously become problematic. And I have been looking into providing a statutory adjustment for the Division of Motor Vehicles to be able to provide an expedited real ID. All of those fees are listed in statute, so therefore we have to make that change. But if there was something that we would need to do to help inmates be able to get that, that might be the time, is to put them together. So let us know what we may do to be able to assist that, since we are on a limited time frame in case someone were needing to fly after October. Okay. Or a federal court building, which might be the case for them.
And in that response, I'd be interested in knowing which facilities have the ability to issue state-recognized IDs when someone is reentering, as opposed to making them go to a DMV afterward.
Mr. Chair, what I can tell you about that is we do issue, we have a DOC ID. It's basically a piece of paper. It's a voucher that that has the individual's picture and identification on it that confirms their identification, and that DMV does accept. So, but they still do have to get to the DMV. We provide them with a voucher, so that is actually paid for. And about 12% of our population are requesting assistance with getting an ID as they're releasing.
Got it. Well, my understanding is the DMV has, with their receipt authority, I think the last number I recall is like $20 million in current capacity. And I just wonder, has the department reached out to DMV to try to bring ID services into the facility, perhaps on some itinerant basis, so that everyone leaving the facility who needs one could actually have a driver's license, ideally a real ID, to the extent they have the paperwork, but at least a driver's license, rather than making them go through one more step?
Mr. Chair, I know there have been conversations about that. Okay. and we can get an update for you on where that is.
Okay. Did you have a question, Representative Story? Okay. Well, seeing no other questions, I really appreciate all the department's time in preparing the report and in discussing this with us, and also in listening to the suggestions of the folks from the therapeutic courts. At 5:04, the State Affairs hearing is adjourned.